like to introduce to you the Diamond of Alabama, Mickey Hawkins. Make her welcome.
I guess I'll accept that. I am Mickey Hawkins, and I'm a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. Hi. It's a pleasure to be back here, and I guess it's a pleasure to share. I never get used to this. I never enjoy this, but this is a part of my program, and it says I have to do it. And so I do the best that I can, and I pray, and I've asked several of you out there to pray for me that I can get myself out of the way and let God and the program speak through me. Jim is going to talk tonight, and so you probably will notice some discrepancies in our story. I want to let you know mine's the correct version. So, I'm not a joke teller, but I'm going to tell you one this morning. Since Roe can't remember his, well, I'll tell you one. There was these two Al-Anons walking through the cemetery, and they saw this tombstone there, and it had the man's name on it. And then down under the name, it said, "Here lies a good man." And one of them turned to the other one and said, "Why did they put two men in the same grave?" And I've got another one. I've got another one I want to share with you. And everybody, when I start, they say, "Oh, it's one of these shaggy dog stories, you know." There's this little alcoholic farmer, and he raised cattle. And so he had this big old herd of cattle out on his farm, and he was out there working one day, and there's a little airplane came and sat down, flying saucer type deal, sat down in the field, and the door opened, and steps came down. This little old man got out and came down there, told him he wanted to buy his herd of cattle. And the guy thought he was hallucinating, you know, and so he said, "I'll give you $1 million for your herd of cattle." And the guy thought about it, and he said, "But it's got to be hard American cash." And he said, "That's no problem, I got it." So he opens up his suitcase, and here's this $1 million in cash. So he pays him for the cattle. He looks over at this airplane, and here comes the little cow down the steps, and he comes over and he just gobbles up the whole herd of cattle. So then this guy goes home and he tells his wife. Well, she's pre-Al-Anon, say so. She doesn't believe a word of this, but he's got the money, so she can't argue with that too much. But he decided next time he'd buy some sheep. So next week he went out and bought a herd of sheep and put them on his farm. And a day or two, here comes the same plane, same little man, so went through the same procedure and offered him the same amount of money. So the guy took the money, and a little old sheep come down out of the plane, went over and gobbled up the whole herd of sheep. So he goes home and he tells his wife about it, and she said, "I just don't understand this. There's just something going on here that I don't understand." But he still had another $1 million. So she didn't argue with that too much. You know how we are. And so he decided then he'd buy some pigs. So he bought this bunch of pigs and put on his farm. And same thing happened. This man comes and offers him $1 million. And he sells it to him. And the little pig comes down out of the plane, comes over and gobbles up the whole herd. And a lady, of course, the lady had decided, well, this time when he takes the pigs down, I'm going to see what for sure. I'm going to see for myself. So she goes with him to tend the pigs. And so when this happened, she saw the man come down and then saw the little pig come down and gobble up the whole herd. So she stood there and she thought about this for a minute. And she looked at him. She says, "You don't have a little alcoholic in there, do you?" I kind of liked that one. I grew up in Kentucky, and I lived there the first 19 years of my life. I came from a good family. We didn't have a lot of money, but we had a lot of love and a lot of good stuff in our life. There was three of us girls and two boys, and mother was a disciplinarian in our family, and she taught us all the good things that she knew. And some of the things that she taught me, I think, she taught all us girls this, and I think maybe some of the things that she taught us maybe added to the guilt as the disease of alcoholism progressed. She always taught us girls to never marry a man who had who drank or who had been married before. And so when I met Jim at a New Year's Eve party in 1944. That's going to be 50 years in December. And he was drinking, and the first dance that we danced, he told me he had been married before and that he had a little girl from this marriage. Well, I didn't remember what my mother had taught me about, or had been telling me, because I had no intentions of getting involved with him. I was engaged to another fellow, and so I didn't mean to get involved with him. I was just going to play around with him for a while, and then we'd go our separate ways. Well, we played too well. We got married the 21st of the next December. So this December 21st, we will be married 49 years. That is, if we make it. And and sometimes it's even doubtful till today, you know. Not really. But we got married, and things went along pretty good. We was like the normal, I think, the normal young people. He drank. About 6 months before we married, I started drinking with him, and I enjoyed our drinking. I enjoyed the partying that we did, and if Jim would have drunk like I did, we'd still be drinking today, because I liked everything about it. I loved the taste. I loved what it did for me, but it just didn't do for me what it did for him. And so it started being a problem. We had some problems even during the dating time. There was some problems then, but not, you know, not bad. But then after we married, he kind of slacked back on his drinking some, and I got pregnant right away, so I cut back on mine. In fact, I cut it out completely for a while, because I thought if I was drinking and I should drop the baby or hurt the baby, I just couldn't take that. So I just quit the drinking and didn't drink for a long time. I don't know just how long. And I've often thought back about this. I was so possessive of this baby. I probably pushed Jim out of my life. Because I have a tendency to be this way. I go overboard in about anything I do for a while, you know, and then I adjust to it and calm down and go on. But I know that I did not want to go off and leave this baby. I wanted to have a perfect baby. I want to be a perfect mother, and I want to be a perfect wife. I want to be a perfect daughter-in-law. He had this one marriage that was a failure, and I didn't think he deserved another wife that was a failure. And of course, you know, in my opinion, it had to be her. Couldn't be nothing wrong with him. So I wanted to be perfect for everybody, you know. And So I insisted that he go. I didn't want to be a nag. We was young. We were still very young at this time. So I insisted that he go out with the fellas. I kept insisting that he go out with the fellas. And I even said, you deserve one night a week out. So he started going out with the fellas. And pretty soon he starts going out with the girls. I didn't like this too well. This caused a little bit of problem. Now, usually all through my tape talk, I will refer occasionally to me thinking that he stepped out on me. I don't know that he did. I thought he did. And one of my fellow Alma members says, if we thought it, it hurt just as bad. If the behavior was such as made us think it, then it hurt just as bad as if it had happened. So, and of course, Jim hasn't ever admitted to this. So, I couldn't say definitely that he stepped out on me, but I thought that he did. But we progressed on this way, and all of you know that the disease of alcoholism is progressive. And my reaction to the disease was just as progressive as his disease was. I got just as sick as he did, and just as quickly as he did. I became obsessed with getting him to quit drinking. Now, for a long time, I didn't want him to quit because I enjoyed drinking. I just wanted him to drink like normal people did, not let it be a problem to us. So I was on this kick all the time and always talking to him about how much he should drink and how much he shouldn't drink and so on and so forth. I read every article that I could find on drinking. It didn't matter what kind of a book it was in. If it talked about drinking alcohol, I read it. I learned through reading all this, I learned that Jim didn't want to be the way he was, but that he had this compulsion that he couldn't control anymore, that he had no choice anymore. He drank because he had to. So then I started asking God to remove this compulsion from him. I've always been a prayer. I've prayed since I was 4 years old. I can remember when a prayer was answered at the age of four. So I've always believed in prayer, and usually my talk is, I say usually because I don't ever know what I'm going to say next, but usually my talk is filled with prayer, and because it's always been a real part of my life. But I started praying for God to remove this compulsion from Jim, and I prayed this for years, and it wasn't done until he got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And since I've got into the program and have enjoyed the results of the program, so I am so grateful that God did not answer that prayer in the way and in the time that I asked him to. I wanted it done then, and I just thought I knew how it should be done. But this is a good example to me, is till today I have to remember this. Let time take time. Let God work in his way, in his time, because all through our life there has been things that happened that I wanted done now. And I wanted it done my way. I thought I knew how it was done, should be done. And I used to go through this thing with God, this is what I would like to happen. And I think if you did it this way, then this would be the result. Well, I have found out, God don't need my direction. Another prayer that I used to pray, and this is one of those examples I thought of when I sang that, is I used to pray for God to kill Jim. So one night he was out, and I don't know how long I had been praying for him to have this accident, because you see, I had left Jim on numerous occasions. I had sued him for divorce. I had threatened. And all of this was to cause him to quit drinking. I never intended to divorce him and stay gone, you know. But it was to show him what he was doing and convince him he had to quit drinking. And I had decided that I couldn't do all these things that I had tried to do through the years, and so I had seen what divorce did for this, my little stepdaughter, his daughter by this previous marriage. So I didn't want this for my children. So I thought, well, I can't divorce him. I can't live with him. So somebody needs to kill him, and I don't want to go to jail for him. He's not worth it. So, and besides, we had these two children somebody needed to raise. So I asked God to kill him. And one night I was praying about this, and I said, God, you know, he's over on 280. That's where he hung out a lot over there. And I said, this would be an ideal place. So you see, I still gave God his directions. And I've been so grateful that he didn't do that. And I'm sure that God knew that I was just as sick as Jim, if not sicker. But there were so many prayers that I did this way that God didn't answer then. And I'm so grateful for that. But then March the 10th of 1955 was the beginning of our recovery. I don't know how long Jim had been gone, and those of you who have heard Jim or me before know that he was a traveling drunk. He would leave, sometimes he'd be gone all night, and sometimes he'd be gone 3 weeks. I never knew. And I went from that person who, if he was 30 minutes late from work, I worried about him if he was 30 minutes late, to if he was 3 hours late, to 6 hours, to all night. And then I got to the point within that 10-year period, if he ever stayed out all night, I knew he'd be gone at least a week. And then I knew that the children and I would have at least 1 week that we didn't have to put up with drinking, we didn't have to put up with him, and we could do what we wanted to do. Now, that's how much I changed in that 10-year period. So this March the 10th of 1955, I got up, and I went in, and I got my children off to school. These two younger daughters, the other little girl had gone to live with her mother, and I would like to have gone to Memphis and lived with her mother, too. Yeah, anything to get out of what I was living in. And so I don't know at this time how long Glenda had been gone. I guess 2 years. There was a lot of things happened like this 2 years just before he came into. That was a jam-packed 2 years of our getting sicker and sicker and sicker and doing things that brought us around to finally to this point of doing something for recovery. But I got the children off to school that morning, and we must have been up at least an hour doing around in our little old house, and it was a small house. And when I turned around from kissing them goodbye on the front porch, Jim was laying on the sofa in the den. And to this day, I don't know whether Jim was lying there when we got up or whether he had driven into the driveway during this hour, got out of the car and come in and laid down, or whether he drove the car into the driveway and got out. I don't know. But I didn't say anything to him, and I went on back and I laid down. And today I didn't pray the same kind of prayers that I had been praying. I just said, God, our life is in a mess, and I don't know what to do about it. And He said, go see a doctor. I heard his voice as plain say that as I hear mine now. I have never doubted for a moment that this was not God's voice. Now, since that time, he has talked to me in many different ways, and I know that the majority of you have experienced this too, so I don't have to tell y'all anything. I'm not telling you anything new. But I got up and I went in and I told Jim I wanted him to go see a doctor, and he started telling me all the reasons why he couldn't go. And this first time since we had been married that I had ever been strong enough to stand up to Jim and insist that he do something I wanted him to do. Always before, it was not the right time, not the right place, or it cost too much money. And I would back down for peace in the family. I would back down. But this morning, when I look back on all this, I know that God was giving me the courage to do this. When I look back on this, I know that God was in this completely. And so I insisted that Jim go to see the doctor. And he went to this doctor this afternoon, and the doctor talked to him, and he said, well, Mr. Hawkins, I can't help you, but I know some people who can, if you'll let me call them. Well, the miracle of this is that we had never been to this doctor before, and we've never been to him since. And he recommended Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, in 1955, there was not too many doctors recommending Alcoholics Anonymous. But Jim told me I had to go ahead and call him. Well, I had heard of Alcoholics Anonymous twice before. And one of these things was in some of these readings that I did, was I had was reading this magazine, and it told about Alcoholics Anonymous out on the West Coast. And all I got out of what I read was that this was a place where drunk men and drunk women went to make contact. Well, I didn't think Jim needed any help in this area. So I didn't search this out. And then sometime during this period of time, I had talked with my minister. He had called me and wanted me to take a job at church. And I'd been trying to hide it all the time, but this time I said, Brother Sewell, I can't do this. I said, Jim just drinks so much that I just can't take on anything else. And he said, well, I had heard that he did. And what you need to do is to get him so busy in the church that he won't have time to drink. And I said, that won't work. I've tried it, and it won't work. So he said, well, in that case, and I have heard of a group in Bessemer that calls themselves AA, and they do help some people. Well, he didn't sell me, see, so I didn't seek this out either. But anyway, this December the 10th, these two men did come out and talk to Jim that night, and he went to his first AA meeting that night. And I went with him on Saturday night to a potluck supper. They did not have a meeting. It was just a dinner. But I fell in love with these people. I knew that they were decent people. And I hadn't had any decent people around me in years. So I fell in love with him, and I started going to AA with Jim, and there was no Al-Anon in Alabama then. So for the next 6 years, I went to the open AA meetings in Bessemer with Jim, and we went to anniversary parties, and we just went all the time. We become as addicted to the AA as we had been to the drinking, you know, and I loved every minute of it. For the most part. Now, I liked, I got a little resentful at our group, our home group, because they was telling me all the time, you know, about what a good husband I had, how good looking he was, and how proud of him I should be. Well, Jim had been telling me this for 10 years. And I got sick and tired of hearing it from him, and I certainly got sick and tired of hearing it from them. So I got a resentment toward this, and so I quit going to our group. Friends tales. I used to go to this group after I got all these resentments, and I'd go sit over on a couch and pick up. Remember, we didn't have no Al-Anon. We didn't have no Al-Anon literature, but I'd pick up the grapevine, and I'd sit there and read it. And I know that my body language and the look on my face said, "Don't dare speak to me." And friends always said that. She said, "Jim sure is a nice guy, but what's wrong with his wife?" But this went on for those 6 years. And I got sicker, and Jim stayed sober in spite of me. I've always said that where there's a couple in AA and Al-Anon, the non-alcoholic being in Al-Anon has got to make the marriage better. But the alcoholic can do it without them, because Jim did it without my support. And there's another thing I want to say here that I thought about this last night when Bill was talking about his wife, about Helen, how what a wonderful person she is and how she supported him in every way. You know, Jim used to do that during that 6 years. He used to tell him that. And I'd sit back there and seethe, because I knew the minute we walked out of that building, he was going to criticize me for something. And I'd think, how in the hell can you stand up there and tell everybody what a good person I am and how much you love me and then treat me like you do when we get home? And so I went through all of this kind of stuff, you know. So it's helpful when y'all preach, practice it at home, too. In 1961, June of 1961, we got the Bessemer Al-Anon family group started, and that is the best thing that ever happened to me. I was one of the originators of the group, and nobody else seemed to be too interested, and there was lots of times that there would be nobody there but me. And lots of times there would be me and another girl from another group that did not have an Al-Anon group. And she, when Mary had come over, we would have a regular Al-Anon meeting. We had that one book, Al-Anon Family Groups, and we went by that format. See, I was so dumb that I thought I had to do everything by the book. And I am so grateful today that I didn't have any more sense, that I had to go right by that book. But if it was just me there, I would pray and I would read the book and meditate. And so all of this time was good for me. I got awfully angry at some of the people, some of the other non-alcoholics in the Bessemer group, because I thought they were not supporting and that they should be there. And but you know, today I'm kind of grateful. Today I'm kind of grateful that I had that time, because I had to study the book. And I got a lot of prayer time in. And during this 6 years though that I went with Jim before Al-Anon, I'm grateful for the alcoholics sharing their program with us non-alcoholics. They accepted us just like we was one of you. And they shared that program with us, and I learned so much from them, and I am so grateful today for that. And some of those people, most of them are all dead now, but I loved them dearly, you know, and I still do today. And they just enriched our lives so much. They took us everywhere and did things with us and was at the house all the time. And it was just like a warm family. And that's just meant so much to me because I had not had this for such a long, long time. But I got into Al-Anon, and I learned so much there, and I'm still learning in Al-Anon today. I often use the phrase of staying green and grow. You know, as long as I don't get too intelligent about this thing, as long as I don't get to thinking that I have all the answers, then I will be able to hear something you say. And it's amazing the things that I hear from you. It's amazing the things that I hear from some of these new people. And I need today to go to Al-Anon, and I do. I go to my home group 2 nights a week. And but see, this keeps me reminded of truths that I forget. If I don't read my Al-Anon literature and I don't associate with Al-Anon people, then I will forget a lot of this. But if I stay close and I stay green and I listen and learn, then I'm going to be okay. And Mary and I think it was this morning, was talking about how often we have to stop and check ourselves to see if we are living by the Al-Anon program. But I attempt to read something about Al-Anon every day. I do sponsor, and I have a sponsor, and I do anything in my group. I have a home group that I support in any way that I can support it. I don't do as much service work as I used to do, and there's two reasons for that. And I made a statement Thursday night in a Thursday night meeting that I don't get the same high out of my regular meetings as I used to. And I think the reason I don't is because I don't do as much service work as I used to. And there's two reasons for that. One is we've got so many new capable people today that needs to be doing it, because I grew from service. They need to grow from service. But also, I'm tired. So, you know, I fall back on that thing. But still, at the same time, I'm still not getting the same out of the program as I used to get. I am getting enough to keep me going. But in Al-Anon, I learned to live one day at a time. And this has been tremendous for me, because I used to live in the future or in the past. Now, I could live in that past real good, and I could bring it up at a moment's notice if it would serve a purpose for me. And I thought on it so much that I lived a very negative life. And then I worried about when I got 65. I just didn't know what in the world would happen. I knew I could work and make a living for the children. But then what was going to happen when I got disabled or 60, 65 and wasn't able to work anymore? But when I got into Al-Anon, I learned that I could be happy today with what I've got. And that was a tremendous lesson for me when I realized that I can be happy today. I don't have to wait tomorrow or next week or next month or 6 months or a year down the road to be happy. I can be happy today. And I use this. I use this all the time. And regardless of what bad is happening in my life, I can handle it today. I can handle anything for one day. Sometimes I have to get it down in 5 minutes or so. But I can do that, and I can get through it. But if I can just get myself aside and say, well, now, you know, today there is nothing you can do about that. Accept it. Then I can get through that day okay. I used to sponsor a girl, and she called me Scarlett O'Hara. She would call me and cry and moan, and I'd listen to all this, and finally I'd say, "Okay, Bonnie, what can you do about it today?" "Well, nothing. If I could, I'd be doing it." I said, "Okay, let's go to bed and get a good night's sleep. Take it up in the morning." And I did this so many times, she nicknamed me Scarlett O'Hara. But, you know, we all have life situations that come into our life, and they're everyone different. Every one of them is different. Thank God I haven't had the active disease of alcoholism back in my life, but I've had other things in my life. We've got these three daughters, we've got 9 grandchildren, and we've got 10 or 11 great-grandchildren. I lost count. But you know, when you have this many people and this many different personalities, you're going to have some problems. We've had health problems. We've had a lot of things, just a lot of things, like life brings you. But I can handle any of it one day at a time. And this is what sometimes I have to do. And then sometimes I have to go down back and I say, "God, I don't know how to handle this, but you do. And I don't have to give you instructions on how to handle it or when to handle it." So that in itself has just been tremendous to me. All of those slogans have been so good for me. In the beginning, I couldn't comprehend the steps and the traditions. The slogans was the only thing I could remember. And so they helped me along until I could work the steps in my life. And then, of course, the traditions was next. And this whole program has been hard for me. This whole program has been slow coming to me. I'm a slow learner. But I think in being slow with it, maybe I have got a good foundation. I don't know. At least I hope I have. But I learned that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable. See, I did not know my life was unmanageable. I thought if he would do right, if he would just do what I told him to, then our life would be okay. Our life would be manageable. But I learned that my life is unmanageable. My life is unmanageable today unless I do just what I've been telling you. Unless I go by the tools that the Al-Anon program has taught me and lean on this higher power that I have come to know in this program. My life is just as unmanageable today as it was before. And as I said earlier, I forget some of this and I go back. I go back to my old behavior. And so I'm grateful for step one. Step two, that came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I didn't think I was insane, and I told them I was not insane, and I told them girls in that Al-Anon group in Bessemer that step two didn't belong to us. We were Christians, we believed, and we were not insane. It was them over there that was insane. We took our program out of the AA program so it was easier to leave step two in than it was to take it out. So I didn't bother with step two. Now, I was already working on step three and sometimes step four, but I just skipped over step two. And I was in an Al-Anon meeting one night in my third year of Al-Anon. And I'd already been going to AA meetings with him for 6, which now it was 9. So see, I'm a slow learner. But I was there, and another girl had the meeting, and I was looking at the steps over here and the traditions over here in the Bessemer group. And as she was having the meeting, and I don't know whether it was on the steps or what it was on, but it was just as if a light arched over step two, and all of a sudden, it was clear to me, yes, step two does belong to me, and it does belong to the Al-Anons just as much as it does the alcoholic. in some part of our, and I think it's in the closing, they change these things around on me and I lose them. But it says that we often think that this does not apply to us. These steps do not all apply to us. But if we'll be thoroughly honest with ourselves, we will realize that they do apply to us just as much as the alcoholic. And then we start applying them to our daily lives one day at a time the best we can. And so that's what I've done through the years. One day at a time, I attempt to apply this program to my life to the best of my ability for that day. But as I sat there and I looked at that step, I remembered several of the things that I had done while during the drinking times that was insane. I remembered a lot of things that I had done since his sobriety and my 3 years in Al-Anon that was insane. Insane thinking. And I was emotionally ill. I was not crazy, but I was so emotionally ill, I knew that I should be locked up in the state hospital. And I was so emotionally ill that I was looking forward to the day when they would lock me up because I wanted the peace and quiet that I thought would be there for me. And so I thought about that this morning or this night that I sat there, and I thought about another thing that I had done a few years before he came into the program. I don't know just how long this was before he came into the program. But as I told you, I had always thought that he stepped out on me. So during this period of time, when the children were real small, I decided that I would have an affair and just show him how it felt. Now, I have always been one that would retaliate if it killed me. I would get even no matter what. And that's what I did all the time, you know. So, and I've learned in Al-Anon, I don't have to do that. And that's so good. But I decided that I would have this affair and show him just how it felt. And so I started thinking about who I could have this affair with. We lived in a little old place in Victoria, Arkansas, if any of you know anything about it. It's just a little old crossroads. Very few people lived there, and I got to thinking about this one fella. His name was Bill. He lived down the street from us, and I thought Bill was single, and I thought, well, now maybe, you know, I could pull this off with Bill. And Bill was a tall, thin fella, just a very tall, thin fella. And he wore a hat that sat straight on top of his head. And his hat, his hair, his eyes, his skin, his clothes, and everything was just one color. And my daddy always said you could tell somebody that wasn't too swift because their eyes would be close together. Bill's eyes was real close together. So I said, no, Jim knows me too well. He knows I wouldn't fool around with somebody like old Bill. So then I thought of Joe. Well, Joe was a nice-looking, black-headed, blue-eyed fella, and real nice-looking. He was also single. And I thought, well, now maybe I could do this with Joe. And I thought, no, Joe's probably with Jim because they ran around together nearly all the time. So I thought of this other man who was married, but he lived up in Blytheville, Arkansas, which was like 21 miles from where we live, and he would come down once a week and pick up our laundry and dry cleaning and take it back to Blytheville, and then he would come back and pick it up. So I knew him real well, and we talked about our children together a lot, and I decided, well, maybe I could make this work with him, you know. And so I went out into the restaurant where we had these big old boxes of old empty beer bottles and went through all them old dirty, empty, stinky beer bottles and got out several of his brand and several of my brand. and took them out and set them up in our bedroom. And now I thought, well, now, you know, that looks like I had somebody back here. And then it dawned on me, Jim and I smoked cigarettes, and this guy smoked cigars. So I had to go back out to the restaurant and get his brand of cigars, and took them back and chewed off one end and lit the other. Like I'd see cigar smokers do. I set that up in the ashtray, and I looked back, and I admired my work, and I thought, now, Jim will really fall for this. He will really believe I had some man back here all night while he was gone. And this was 2 weeks before our last child was born. I did an awful lot of stupid thinking during those drinking days. And but this is what I thought about there that night when I was thinking about step two. And there's another thing that I'm going to share with you. I usually share this. This is what I call my parakeet story. And there is still young folks out here that have children in the house, or maybe grandchildren, I don't know, that it might help you to release them. We had this beautiful little 17-year-old daughter that the one, it was our first one, the one that I possessed, so, and I was going to make perfect, and I did not want this child to ever suffer pain. So I was going to do everything for her or tell her how to do it right, and then she wouldn't have to suffer any pain, see. So she was dating this little old boy. She was 17 now and just beautiful, just a beautiful girl, and so impeccable in her dress and her hair and her makeup and everything. And she was dating this little old boy who let the fuzz grow on his hair. Now, he didn't have the hippie long hair. He had the fuzz just growing down on his neck and shirt tail out. He wore his shirt tail out, and he wouldn't go to school and couldn't work because he didn't have enough education to work, you know. So he was just a nothing, and just everything that no mother would want for her daughter. And so I did all of the things. I said all the wrong things and acted in all the wrong ways that so many mothers do. And the more I did, the closer they got together. And it looked as if they were going to marry in spite of everything we did. She was now into her senior year in high school. And I'd been in Al-Anon now somewhere about 4 years, and I would talk to the people in the Bessemer group, and I'll have to say that the AAs helped me with this as much as the Al-Anons did. I talked to both groups the same way, and we had some Al-Anon women in that group that helped me so much, and they're my dearest friends today because I could talk with them and tell them about what was going on between this girl and me. And the only thing they ever did is if they had something similar, they would share it with me. If they didn't, they didn't try to tell me what to do. They just said, pray about it. And one of the things that I knew then, and I've known every day since, not one time did one of those people, whether it was AA or Al-Anon, ever try to tell me that if I'd have been a better mother, if I had handled that child differently, that this wouldn't be happening. Not one time did one of those people ever try to tell me that my daughter was a bad girl. She wasn't. And not one time, and I know this for truth, they didn't get around behind my back and talk about her or talk about me. And I have always been grateful for this. And they had a love and a concern for me and for that child. But they'd say, pray about it. And this is what I did. And I prayed and I prayed and I prayed and I prayed. And there was things that happened that I could see that God was working in this situation. But it wasn't happening as quickly as I wanted it to. So I just continued to pray and pray. And I kept trying to figure this thing out. See, I had got to the place with my daughter that I felt like, well, after all I've done for her, and after all I have said to her, and all this wisdom I have given her, if she still chooses him, then she deserves him. And they can live off down there in the country with his people, but they're not living with me. You know, this was what I was in at this time. But I didn't worry about my daughter anymore. I was worrying about the children she might have. And my grandchildren sitting off down there in the country with them low-class people with the bugs and gnats crawling all over me. It was driving me nuts. It was just driving me crazy. And so I prayed about this all the time. And I was talking about this to God one night. You know, what am I going to do if this happens, if she has this baby and they're sitting off down there in the country and baby's sitting out there with nothing on but a diaper and bugs and stuff crawling all over it. And this was another way that God talked to me. The thought came to me, what have you got today? What is your life like today? And I stopped and I thought about it. I had a good life. My husband was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, had been some 10 years now. I was in Al-Anon, and I was relatively happy. At that time, I thought I was happy, so much better than I had been before. Our children were active in Alateen. We had more money in the house than we had ever had before because what Jim's always made good money, but it didn't always get home. Now it was coming home, so we had more money than we'd ever had before. We had a better relationship between each other than we had ever had before. And we had a better relationship with the God of our understanding. So I thought, okay. So if all of this came to us out of the suffering that we had done from the disease of alcoholism, then who was I to deprive my child of some suffering? She had to suffer what she had to suffer to get whatever she needed in life. So I released her. So I asked God to give me the strength and the wisdom to do the things that I should do to bring about his will in her life and in mine. And I got up the next morning and I told her that I was not going to interfere in her life anymore, that I knew she had enough sense to make up her own mind, and that I did not know what was best for her. I had gotten smart enough in Al-Anon to know that I did not know what was best for me. So I certainly did not know what was best for her. And she said, well, Mama, that's always been the problem. I thought you knew what was best, but I couldn't always do what you wanted me to do. So I told her, I said, okay, as a parent, I think it's my duty if you ask my opinion. I'm supposed to tell you what I think. But remember, you don't have to use it. It's just what I think. And for the next 2 months, she would come to me and ask me these things, and I'd tell her what I thought. But I'd also say, but remember, you don't have to use that. Do your own praying and your own thinking and make up your own mind. And so in 2 months' time, she was broke up with this boy. And so some time down the road, I don't know how many months or years after this, I was at a convention in Macon, Georgia, and I had heard a good Al-Anon man say, he talked about let go and hold. He had just read an article, and the title was Let Go and Hold, and he talked on this article, And so it goes something like this. You can hold your parakeet in the palm of your hand, and it will sit there and enjoy your warmth until you start putting pressure on it. But once you start putting pressure on it, it will start squirming. And the more pressure you put on, the more it squirms until it's literally crushed to death. This is what I was doing to my child. I was crushing the dignity out of her. She had sense, but I was crushing this out of her, trying to mold her into my thinking. The article went on to say that if you would release your hand, the parakeet would fly away, but it would come back to you. This is what happened to our daughter. When I released my hold on her, then she could make her own choices. And she made her choices. And her life has been good. But by doing this, this gave she and I an opportunity to be friends. We've been friends all down through the years. And she just lost her husband a year ago in August. It has helped me in this. She is the type person today. She's 48 years old, but she is still the type person she would like for you to tell her what to do. But she's still going to do what she wants to. But I did not have to fall back into that same thing, that same pattern of taking this middle-aged lady back in and crushing her to death. You know, I could let her fly free, let her make her own decisions. So what if she did them wrong? So what if she made mistakes? We all do, but we learn from them. And there's not any of them that, you know, it's just irrevocable. So Al-Anon has helped me raise my children. Al-Anon has made me a better wife, and I know this. Jim and I have a good relationship today. Sometimes I struggle with a lot of things in my life. But getting back to Green and Grow, a year or so ago I read the 3 A's. You know, we got the 3 C's, and now we got some 3 G's and 3 P's. You know, we got a lot of these things that we pick out to help us through rough spots. But this 3 A's is awareness, acceptance, and then action. And, you know, I can become aware of a situation, but it takes me a long time sometimes to accept it. And then it takes me a while longer to decide what action to take. And then I heard somebody else say, or adjustment. You know, we could add the 4 A's there, adjustment to the situation. But there is nothing in this life that I can't handle one day at a time, with the tools that the Al-Anon program has given me, and that the love and the fellowship and the support that I see always in my people of Al-Anon and AA. And for this, I am very grateful.